This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program features an essay written by Annie Finch about our visit with the poet Carolyn Kaiser last fall, and a reading by Philip Terman, author of The Torah Garden and Rabbis in the Air. If there's time, I'll be happy to fill it with even more poetry. In October of 2013, I heard from Maine poet Annie Finch that she was in the San Francisco Bay Area. She expressed an interest in visiting the poet Carolyn Kaiser, to whom she has a very special connection, but didn't know how to reach her. Joyce Jenkins, the untiring editor of Poetry Flash, also wanted to visit Kaiser. As a result, I contacted the care home where Kaiser is residing and arranged for the three of us to meet her there on Wednesday, October 23rd. The visit was intensely moving. I'm certain that all three of us wrote about it as soon as we were able. I know I did. But Finch, who read her poem, A Carol for Carolyn, on this program recently, has published an essay about the visit on the website for the Poetry Foundation. If you're not familiar with the foundation, I encourage you to visit poetryfoundation.org. When I read Finch's essay, I was moved again to tears. Happily, both she and the foundation have given me permission to read this essay on the air. Here is Annie Finch's remembrance of our visit. Visiting Carolyn Kaiser, mentorship from a woman poet is no small thing. It is easy to be a poet, brim with transparent water. Carolyn Kaiser's book, Mermaids in the Basement, was open on the table before me, but I recited the lines from memory as I scanned the familiar yet strange face so close to mine for any sign that their author recognized them in all their bravura and beauty. The beloved words rose up through my voice, then spread out through the small room. Kaiser's sharp gray eyes focused, glittered, and then radiant recognition came. A bigger, sweeter smile than any I'd ever seen her bestow in the 25 years I'd known her broke loose across her face. She looked suddenly youthful, and all of us were charmed, repaid, transported in the echo of the words of her poem, in the eloquent silence of that smile. We had come, three women poets, Catherine Hastings, host of the Word Temple Poetry Program on Sonoma County's KRCB-FM, Joyce Jenkins, editor of the Bay Area's Poetry Flash, and I, on a reading tour for my selected poems, Spells, from my home in Maine, to pay tribute to the one of the last of a generation. Born into the same generation of Plath, Sexton, Cumin, Clifton, Rich, Lord, Levertov, and Brooks, Carolyn Kaiser has been one of the most manifestly feminist of that breakthrough wave of women poets. A native of Spokane, Washington, she enrolled in Theodore Retke's poetry class at the University of Washington in 1954 as a recently divorced 29-year-old mother of three young children. She went on to become a founding editor of Poetry Northwest, editor of such anthologies as 100 Great Poems by Women and The Essential John Clare, the first director of literary programs for the NEA, and author during the 1970s and beyond of 8 books of poetry, including the powerful and classic poems Pro Femina, Bitch, Semele Recycled, and A Muse of Water. Her brilliant book Yin, New Poems, turned down by just about every major poetry publishing house, was finally picked up by the small press BOA Editions and then awarded, adding an everlasting tale to the store of poets' consolations, the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1984. Like so many other women who knew Carolyn, each of us three that day felt indebted to her in complex and poignant ways. Each of us had found her not only a literary inspiration and role model, but also a supportive mentor. Kaiser, after meeting me briefly once and reading the manuscript that I had sent at her encouragement, had offered to write a review of my first book of poetry. She had also urged me to visit her friend Marie Ponsot in New York, telling me, "Go with your book tucked under your arm." She would send Christmas cards, one consisting of a hilarious poem with the refrain, "Major poets don't send Christmas cards." This was precious to me, I think, because I understood a gendered subtext. Male major poets don't usually seem to send Christmas cards, Frost, Wilbur, and Heaney being three notable exceptions, but Carolyn was pulling it off. Mentorship like that from a woman poet was no small thing, especially in the late 20th century. No wonder Joyce, Catherine, and I, all born in the 1950s, treasured our relationship with Carolyn. We had experienced firsthand how singular such a gift was. Maxine Cumin, an exact contemporary of Kaiser's, for example, once told me that the only women poets she mentors are older than she is, women who are even less comfortable than she is in navigating the male-dominated literary world. And Ariel Greenberg and Rachel Zucker include among the mentees in their anthology Women Poets on Mentorship, only women poets born after 1960, because, according to their preface, most women poets born before that were mentored by men, if we were mentored at all. After all, it is only recently that most women have felt themselves in a position powerful enough to mentor anyone, and many of us, even now, have yet to really learn how. If you haven't had the experience of being mentored yourself, it is that much harder to get the hang of it. But Kaiser was the exception. As I drove my rental car north over the Golden Gate Bridge toward Sonoma, Joyce Jenkins shared with me her own tales of Kaiser's generosity. She had encouraged Joyce to publish her first collection of poems and had written a preface for the book. She had donated items to auctions benefiting Poetry Flash and lent her queenly presence to many small readings given by local poets in the Flash's poetry series. As I listened to Joyce, it became clear to me that she had been moved by Carolyn's rare generosity in the same way I had been. I had first promised myself to visit Carolyn during a conversation with Joyce several years earlier, during a literary conference. Joyce told me that Carolyn, then in her mid-80s and suffering from dementia, had been moved out of the house she shared with her architect husband and into an assisted living facility. During the same conversation, Joyce happened to mention that Carolyn had donated several belly dance costumes collected while she was serving as cultural ambassador to Pakistan to an auction to benefit Poetry Flash. Well, that did it. Having an older sister who was once a professional belly dancer, I happened to have a personal relationship with this magnificent art form. Kaiser is the only woman poet of her generation whom I could imagine having belly dance costumes and the audacity to donate them. I was reminded how fiercely I loved this courageous and vivacious woman, the most explicitly sensual woman poet of her generation. So when a reading invitation brought me out west, Joyce and I arranged to drive up to Sonoma to pay our respects. Joyce got in touch with Catherine, who lived in the same county, and she agreed to meet us there. All seemed to be falling into place. But halfway through the drive, just as we were entering the drought-parched brown hills of Sonoma County, we got a phone call from Catherine, who had already arrived. "Carolyn has taken a turn for the worse," she told Joyce. "She may not even recognize you at all. Are you both sure you want to go?" I looked at Joyce, and we were both quiet for a moment, remembering Carolyn in her prime. The jewels, the hair, the fur, the acerbic wit. Did we want to see her old and vulnerable? Joyce looked back at me. I knew she was thinking the way I was. "We're coming anyway," we told Catherine. There was no question about it. We needed this pilgrimage for Carolyn's sake and for our own. For centuries, the relationship of women poets with our poetic forebears has been fraught. Eager to be embraced by the powerful male poetry establishment, women have turned their backs on the women who came before them, disowning their female poetic ancestors as quaint or trivial. As Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubar point out in their landmark 1985 essay, Forward Into the Past, the price of success as a woman poet for centuries was to disown one's literary femininity. If this is still largely true, it was far truer in Kaiser's generation. Kaiser was a magnificent exception. She was never afraid to champion women's poetics and to stand by other women poets. As we drove up to the modest Southwestern-style building, a small group assisted living facility on a quiet cul-de-sac, I felt quiet, anxious, alone. If you had asked me as I entered the building what the purpose of this pilgrimage was, after all, I couldn't have said. I just wanted to see her, that was all. My education had exposed me to many stories of aged male poets at the ends of their lives, blind Milton on his deathbed, dictating poetry to his daughters, Goethe crying, "More light," Whitman with his white beard in Camden, New Jersey, receiving pilgrimages from young poets, Joyce with a young Beckett offering his assistance, Pound in St. Elizabeth's, an elder Hayden Carruth in his cottage in Vermont. But the tales of aged female poets are much fewer, even if they avoided death in childbirth or death by disease, alcohol, or suicide, and survived into old age. They seem to fade into private life with no literary tales wrapped around their legends. So I had no preconceptions about our meeting today, no sense of being part of a tradition or a chain. The three of us walked into the building. Carolyn was brought out to see us in a wheelchair, and I was flooded with how strange it was, how much love I felt for her still, and how bright her smile was. Then, in spite of what we had been warned, it occurred to me that I did feel that she recognized me, and I think Joyce and Catherine also felt recognized. We sat around a table together. We told her how glad we were to see her, how far we had traveled, how important she was to us, how often we had thought of her, and how much her poetry is still admired. She simply smiled back at us. I think we were all captivated by the sweet brilliance of her smile, an open smile almost like a child's, so different from any expression of the wry, witty, and brittle Carolyn we had known before. After a while, something became clear to all of us, and we could no longer avoid acknowledging it. Carolyn was not talking at all. Though her smile, changing and sensitive, alive with knowledge and recognition, was eloquent, she was not speaking any words. After a while longer, I got the idea to read her some poems. That morning, Joyce had given me a tour of the Poetry Flash office, stuffed with poetry memorabilia and a library covering many walls, floor to ceiling. On a whim, we had pulled the Flash's complete Kaiser collection, about a foot and a half of poetry, off the shelf to bring along, thinking Carolyn might enjoy seeing the books. They were piled on the table, and I had also brought Carolyn a copy of my own new book, Spells. So I started with my poem, A Carol for Carolyn, which I had written in tribute to her for a panel at an AWP conference. Quote, "She brims with transparent water, as mother and poet and daughter," unquote. Then I opened the Flash's copy of the 2000 reprint of Pro Femina and read out the beginning. "I will speak about women of letters, for I'm in the racket. Our biggest successes to date? Old maids to a woman. And our saddest conspicuous failures? The married spinsters, on loan to the husbands they treated like surrogate fathers. Think of that crew of self-pitiers, not very distant, who carried the torch for themselves and got first-degree burns. Or the sad sonneteers, Toast and Teasdales we loved at 13, middle-aged virgins seducing the puerile anthologists, through lust of the mind, barbiturate-drenched Camilles, with continuous periods murmuring softly on sofas, when poetry wasn't a craft but a sickly effluvium, the air thick with incense, musk, and emotional blackmail. Did Carolyn recognize her own poem? Her face lit up, and it seemed apparent that she was following every word, nodding proudly at particularly good moments, laughing with her eyes at the funniest parts. Then Joyce and Catherine shared some of their favorite Kaiser poems, reading so beautifully that time stopped, and I read another. We passed the books around the table for a good long while, gifting the poet's poems back to her. The last one I remember reading was this passage from A Muse of Water. We rose in mists and died in clouds, or sank below the trammeled soil, to silent conduits underground, joining the blind fish and the mole. A gleam of silver in the shale, lost murmur, subterranean moan. So flows in dark caves, dries away, what would have brimmed from bank to bank, kissing the fields you turn to stone, under the boughs your axes broke. And so our visit passed, an afternoon out of time. About 90 minutes after we had arrived, the spell finally broke when Carolyn's son arrived for a visit. We spoke with him about the possibility of getting Carolyn a desk and computer in case she wanted to do some writing, and hatched a plan to record some of her own poems and perhaps other favorites so she could listen to them. Through all of this conversation, Carolyn watched with the same keen attention, and through all this time, she never spoke. Finally, there was nothing more for us to say. It was time to go. We hugged Carolyn Kaiser goodbye. We told her again how much we admired her, appreciated her, loved her, and how much her poems mean to so many people. Catherine, who lives nearby, promised to visit her again soon, and reluctantly, we started to make our way toward the door. At that moment, as I gave Carolyn my last hug, it happened. In a voice I will never forget. She looked right into my eyes, and she spoke. And then she repeated the same words to the others. They were her last words to each of us, to all of us. "Thank you," she said. This is Catherine Hastings, and I've been reading an essay written by the Maine poet Annie Finch, Visiting Carolyn Kaiser, Mentorship from a Woman Poet is No Small Thing. This was published on poetryfoundation.org. You can find the article by going there. I want to thank Annie for writing this memory of our visit with Carolyn Kaiser. It was such a special day. I, too, will never, ever forget it. And I want to thank the Poetry Foundation as well for giving permission to read this essay on air. Although I recently aired Annie Finch reading her poem, A Carol for Carolyn, this seems like a very appropriate time to air it once again. So here is Annie Finch reading A Carol for Carolyn.
A Carol for Carolyn. I dreamed of a poet who gave me a wail that shadowed clear pools through the kelp-making shade. When beached sea foam dried on the rocks, it would sail down currents that gathered to pool and cascade with turbulent order. She brims with transparent water as mother and poet and daughter. The surface is broken and arching and full, impelled by the passions of nation and woman. The waves build and fall, the deep currents pull toward rocky pools cupping the salt of the human. The ocean she's authored brims with transparent water for poet and mother and daughter.
And finally, here is a poem by Carolyn Kaiser. This is from her Cool, Calm, and Collected, poems 1960 to 2000. In the first stanza, first I tell you who I am, shadowed, reflective, small pool in an unknown glade. It is easy to be a poet, brim with transparent water. In autumn, the leaves blow down over the ruffled surface, sink to rest, then resume their cycle. In the second stanza, you laugh, skipping pebbles across my surface, charmed by the spreading circles. In the tree's perpetual twilight, you are alone with the poet. Gently, you shake your head. You know me as turbulent ocean, clouded with thunder and drama. In the third stanza, I die. Still, I insist on composing as my throes go on and on. I clench the pen in my teeth, making those furious scratches that you will see much later as graceful calligraphy, drift of sails that sketch my horizon. My hands, in the fourth stanza, with the agonized clutch of the dying, draw your hand beneath the covers. I beg you to travel my body till you find the forest glade. Then your hand, like a leaf in autumn, is pulled into the pool. The rest of you doesn't believe it. The fifth stanza begins with water and quiet laughter. Then I die, I really die. You pick up this piece of paper. You read it aloud and explain me, my profile cast in prose. It drops from your hand like a leaf. This is all part of the cycle. Then, in the final stanza, I tell you who I am. And that concludes the Carolyn Kaiser portion of tonight's program. Before moving on to our next poet, Philip Terman, I want to mention the next Word Temple Poetry Series event that will be taking place this coming Saturday, April 26th at 7 o'clock p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, 282 South High Street in Sebastopol. I will be featuring three poets that evening. David Rosenthal is the author of The Wild Geography of Misplaced Things. This is a really fine book. There's a lot of formal poetry in this book, as well as some playfulness. It's very enjoyable. He will be joined by Leonore Wilson, who is the Poet Laureate of Sonoma Valley. She is the author of two really gorgeous books. One is called Western Solstice, and her latest book, which was just published this year, is Tremendum Augustum. And this was published early this year. Wilson is on the MFA and River of Words advisory boards at St. Mary's College in California, and she's won all kinds of fellowships. So come here, Leonore Wilson also. She's very good. And finally, Todd Melliker, a Sonoma County poet who has had a number of exquisite chapbooks published over the years, has finally had his first full-length collection of poems published. It is called Rendezvous, and you just should not miss Todd reading from this book. Todd is such a risk-taker, and he experiments in all kinds of interesting ways with his poetry, and to my eyes and to my heart, it just always works. So come to the Word Temple Poetry Series on Saturday, April 26th at 7 p.m. for David Rosenthal, Leonore Wilson, Todd Melliker, and mostly for yourself. I hope to see you there. Well, it is National Poetry Month, so before we move on to Philip Terman, and I promise we will get to him very soon, I'm going to play a number of poems by different poets. See if you can recognize who they are. I'll let you know at the end of this.
They are always with us, the thin people, meager of dimension as the gray people on a movie screen. They are unreal, we say. It was only in a movie. It was only in a war, making evil headlines when we were small, that they famished and grew so lean and would not round out their stocky limbs again, though peace plumped the bellies of the mice under the meanest table. It was during the long hunger battle they found their talent to persevere in thinness, to come later into our bad dreams, their menace not guns, not abuses, but a thin silence. Wrapped in flea-ridden donkey skins or bits of burlap, squatting together on granite steps where the mica glinted at noonday like broken glass, famous for their scantness, empty of complaint, forever drinking vinegar from tin cups, they wore the insufferable nimbus of the lot-drawn scapegoat, but so thin, so weedy a race could not remain in dreams, could not remain outlandish victims in the contracted country of the head, any more than the old woman in her mud hut could keep from cutting fat meat out of the side of the generous moon when it set foot nightly in her yard, until her knife had pared the moon to a rind of little light. Now the thin people do not obliterate themselves as the dawn grayness blues, reddens, and the outline of the world comes clear and fills with color. They persist in the sunlit room. The wallpaper frieze of cabbage roses and cornflowers pales under their thin-lipped smiles, their withering kingship. How they prop each other up. They outnumber us in the towns, in the cities, and we own no wildernesses rich and deep enough for stronghold against their stiff battalions. See how the tree boles flatten and lose their good browns if the thin people simply stand in the forest, making the world go thin as a wasp's nest and grayer, not even moving their bones.
If you don't force it. He's talking about interpolations, rifts that come in the midst of action, responding to the line, accommodating the blues, and not neglecting the melody, refusing to smother beauty with too many chords. To show off is to bungle the melody with chordal blocks, not building anything to your baby, hiding the melody like only the young can do. Lester Young would watch the dancers moving into his vernaculars with rhythms augmenting the melody. Herschel would set the pace. Prez would follow. Count would cop time. As though you could improve on stride piano. Ben Webster could do stride. When you get possessed with wild chords, tie your left hand behind your back. Then play the melody with one finger. On your right hand. Put the melody on your heart.
What is our innocence? What is our guilt? All are naked, none is safe. And whence is courage, the unanswered question, the resolute doubt, dumbly calling, deftly listening, that in misfortune even death encourages others, and in its defeat stirs the soul to be strong. He sees deep and is glad who accedes to mortality, and in his imprisonment rises upon himself as the sea in a chasm, struggling to be free and unable to be, in its surrendering, finds its continuing. So he who strongly feels behaves, the very bird, grown taller as he sings, steals his form straight up. Though he is captive, his mighty singing says, satisfaction is a lowly thing. How pure a thing is joy! This is mortality. This is eternity.
And this is Catherine Hastings. You are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. The poets you just heard were Sylvia Plath reading The Thin People, Michael Harper reading If You Don't Force It, and finally, Marianne Moore reading What Are Years? All right, we are going to move on now to Philip Terman, as I have been promising. He is the author of The Torah Garden, published by Autumn House Press, as well as The House of Sages, Book of Unbroken Days, and Rabbis of the Air. We had a little joke going because now he's going to be a rabbi on the air. His poems have appeared in many journals and anthologies, including Poetry, The Georgia Review, and many others. He is the recipient of the Kenneth Patchen Award, the Sow's Ear Chapbook Prize, and the Anna Davidson Rosenberg Award for Poems on the Jewish Experience. Terman teaches creative writing and literature at Clarion University of Pennsylvania, and he also co-directs the Chautauqua Writers Festival and is contributing editor for poetry for the journal Chautauqua. He lives just outside Grove City, Pennsylvania, so I'm really happy that he was able to come to Sonoma County to read for the Word Temple Poetry Series in the fall of 2013. I was unable to record his reading that night, but we got together after that and did record some poems. So here, without further ado, is Philip Terman.
This next poem is, I live in the country, and so I'm originally from Cleveland, a Jewish Cleveland urban guy, but moved to the country. And one of the things that really fascinates me is I write up much from my Jewish background, Jewish culture, which is kind of focuses on law and on Torah, and kind of against nature in a way, against the kind of paganistic naturalistic world. But I live in the country and fell in love with the pagan naturalist world. And so that tension between nature and Jewish law is fascinating to me. And this poem, is about that. Among the Unspoken Names. We would be like the old Jews who knew nothing but devotion and gratitude. Every word was praise, praise, praise. Their bodies as the wind, their lives a poverty, their spirits everything, everything they spoke saying of creation, their stomachs empty, lips parched, eyes hungry for the text. The world was nowhere, even in summer, even as the apples rounded and the quick birds flew their quick flights from branch to branch. Even as sunlight spread itself, even dusk, nothing could sway them outside those pages to which they swayed. We would be like the old sages, for whom it was God this and God that. Nothing was as it was. Everything was something else. That blue jay, that grass, not blue only, not green only. Move closer, closer to the garden, how it floats under the illuminated sky, softer, softer, into that obscure place. Be nothing but an ear, they said. Have you made arrangements, they asked, about this hour, such as it is, this hour of ecstasy and service, this document of midsummer, these days of drought and resurrection? We would be like them. We would turn into the book completely. We would walk around the garden 7 times out of some obscure longing. We would ask our ancestors to explain. We would be like the old interpreters whose words had wings. We would climb the rungs of the ladder, reaching up to the bird's nest. If it weren't for the morning sleep and the midday wine and the children's talk, we would be as those scribes, scribbling our 16 hours a day, tugging the sweetness of the letters, lost happily among the syllables. if it weren't that we were stuck in the midst of all this beauty, if it weren't for these children crouched in the apple tree, faces flushed like apples, voices screeching like blue jays, we would know that the Madonna lilies are not Madonna lilies only, nor the grapes their blood purple, nor their sweetness only. Will our plantings flower as dust? Will our tomatoes suffer again their blight? Or will the cornstalks be as scrolls lifted out of their dwellings, bearing their fruit as plentiful as words? We would, we think, be among the blessed, the unspoken names. We would be among the stories passed down, if it wasn't that we wanted to sing the whole thing, the flesh of the earth, the consuming flames. This next poem is about my father. We lived in the city when I was growing up, as I said, in Cleveland. And my father had a used car lot. He was a used car salesman. But he also had a little garden in the back. We had a very small house, small yard. But he had a little garden. And this is about that as a contrast to his gritty daytime used car lot dealership job. And it references several Jewish heroes, I suppose. Think of David and his pleadings. So what if we return to the same theme again and again? Think of David and his pleadings. Think of Solomon with his grandiose schemes. Think of Jehovah with his continual threats and punishments, his promises and his disappointments. So what if I return to my family, gathered around the set table, waiting for my father, still in the backyard, examining the tomatoes in his garden, shadowed by the garage, how each evening he'd return from his 10-hour-a-day labor and water them, craving his small portion of seed after the hours of asphalt and steel, blaring horns and burning tires. So what if he wanted, after punching out, the smell of soil and grass staining his hands, greased from all-day oil, or if he needed, after the deals, some silence from the complaints and the excuses, the dust and exhaust of Cleveland, the sweat. So what if I returned to the soft and delicate skins he would slice through? Think of Moses and his ultimatum. And eat with a little salt. Okay, a poem from my mother. She unfortunately had Alzheimer's and lost her hearing at the end there. She passed away a couple of years ago. She passed away on September 30th, so it's almost the anniversary of that, at which we say the mourner's Kaddish. But on the last day before she passed away, very close to it, I read her from the book of Ecclesiastes, even though she had Alzheimer's and was deaf. So here's a poem about that. It's called My Mother Argues with Ecclesiastes. And she was very Jewish. That was at the center of her life. So that is there in the poem. At the Wailing Wall, when she danced with the dancers, that was her time. That was her place. She ate and drank and enjoyed all the good of her labor. And now, her body struggling each breath under the purple comforter, her right hand holding the white sheet, her mouth slightly open, her pale cheek sunken, her pink gown open at the breasts, her eyes delicate as moth wings, closed. This almost death mask, these last living moments. Is it true, as it comes to pass, that all, as it says, is emptiness, vanity, these words, this effort, loving all, trusting few, always having something in reserve? If she had one, she needed two, she'd say. If she had two, she needed three. The way she wouldn't trust the banks, a little of her fortune in each, or her sons, a little of her wisdom for each. Not all for one, not the whole in one heart, in case it breaks, and you're left, she'd say, with nothing. And here I am, a good son, or trying to be, at her bedside, reading to her through her Alzheimer's and her stone deafness and her dying, from Ecclesiastes, whom she interrupts with her characteristic chutzpah. "No, you schlemiel," she shouts. "The day of death is not better than the day of birth. Are you a mashugana?" She continues, embarrassing me in front of this wise preacher. "The house of mourning is not greater than the house of feasting. Have you never had children? Have you ever had the Blintzes at Corky's and Lenny's? Have you ever heard Jerry Vale's O Sole Mio? Have you ever drunk 4 cups of wine on Passover? Eat, drink, and be merry. There we can agree." Yet, with this breath that came to my bones in her womb, I continue to read to her. "Sorrow is better than laughter." And I know she's ready to sue him. She's asking for his name and number. In this, the beginning of her ending, under the purple comforter. "One generation passeth away," I continued. "There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things to come." And my mother rises again to kvetch. "Is this man a putz? Is he blind? Is not my son," pointing to me, "my afterlife?" Her breath is slowing now, the nurse applying delicately the morphine. Yet she continues. "Can't he see the bone of my bone, the flesh of my flesh? And so will I, in fact, carry her with me all the days of my life? And what will she carry, empty of her body, the air her sanctuary? Afternoons we would nap together, the shade drawn against the sharp light, and we'd play the game of who falls asleep first, her assuring breath. Inhaling time, exhaling chance, under the purple comforter, arguing with Ecclesiastes from beginning to end. Okay, about 6 years ago, my brother was was jogging, and he was hit by a car, he was 53 years old, and he was a fairly famous scientist, a biologist. He discovered a receptor. He was working at Albert Einstein Medical College cancer research, and he developed a big name for himself, actually, in the cancer research world. It was a big loss to me, but also to the world in that respect because of the work he was doing. And in my book, The Torah Garden, one of the 4 sections is devoted to him in a long 7-part poem, which I'll just read a couple sections of. The poem is called To a Scientist Dying Young, which is based on the poem To an Athlete Dying Young by A.E. Hausman. And I'll just read a couple. I try to bring in the Jewish rituals, but also science. So faith and science is kind of a larger theme here. This is in the Jewish tradition, the body is washed by special people, never by a relative. A brother certainly wouldn't do that because of the mourning period. But this is a poem called Washing the Body, as if I imagine what would my doing that. It's called Washing the Body. I wanted to wash my brother's body the way he washed mine, as children in the bath, squeaking and splashing, his older hand soaping my tender skin. I wanted to touch him one last time, not the way I brushed his chest when he lay exposed in his injury, his breath rising and falling to the rhythm of the machines, but rather to anoint with wet cloth his freckled face, around his blue eyes and small mouth, to work my way down the shoulders and chest and stomach, sponge his thighs and the hair we both inherited from our father and from his father, all the way back to our first hairy father. And so I am cleansing them too, if what we are is some portion of what others leave. And I wanted, while reciting, he must depart as he came in, to clean his nails and brush his hair and sprinkle holy soil onto his flesh and place broken pottery on his eyes, to wrap him in unbleached linen, and place him in the pine container, and recite the prayer of forgiveness for touching him so. The other poem I want to read from the selection is based on the idea that when we have relationships with somebody, we own those moments, somebody really close to you, those moments that you share, you both kind of own those moments together. So this is called What We Own. I followed you down the switchback trail of the Grand Canyon, and we slept in a crevice, and we own that. And we own those moments tossing the football in front of 4073 Wincote Road until the streetlight snapped on. And we own the smoke bomb the cops threw at us and a few thousand others at the Jefferson Airplane Concert, Akron, Ohio, 1972. And we own the whole country we passed through, all the way to the ocean, where we checked into a hotel and you discovered, lying atop Gideon's Bible, a black film canister's worth of weed, and a half a pack of rolling papers. And we smoked it, and it was good, unbelieving of our luck, which we own, and the lunar landscape surrounding our tent in Big Bend, Texas, and the stars, so clear we could read by them, and we did. And we own The Godfather, Part 1, on the big screen of that packed theater in Evanston, Illinois. And we own that fear when we were lost in the Tennessee woods, into the dark. And you followed some analytical instinct until we found, lo and behold, a road. And Bob Dylan, who was ours, and Joan Baez, who was also ours, singing The Times They Are A-Changin' at the War Memorial, and watching the Indians, miracle of miracles, beat the New York Yankees at Yankee Stadium during the 1995 heat wave. That too, that victory was ours. And I remember how quiet you sometimes were, and I asked you about it, and you said, it's a feeling you get, you don't know how to talk about it. And I'd like to think we own that feeling, how we bested the myths. We didn't become murderer and victim. We didn't cheat on the other's birthright. Oh, my brother of the other world, my brother who perhaps will greet me when I arrive at that place prepared for by our Father, who is now joined by his own flesh and blood, which is not flesh, but bones and perhaps spirit, which we believe in. Like the moon, or the unpredictable Cleveland weather, or the way the snow descends on the fallen leaves, or how the sun glazes them now, for their moment, stirred in the slight wind, that same wind that blew the Jerusalem dust in our faces, which we own. Okay, the interesting, fascinating thing about the whole brother experience is that when he was hit by the car, they weren't quite sure what the prognosis was. He was brain dead, but they kept his organs going in order to, you know, continue to investigate. And eventually, we had the organs were transplanted. And he was a scientist, so. And the really fascinating thing is that I got to meet the woman who has his heart. And so the last poem of the series is called Speaking to the Woman with My Brother's Heart. Here you are again, brother, right in front of me, the most essential part of you, your heart, now carried by a 66-year-old grandmother, grateful for your death, I would say, but it would be wrong. She even apologized, though unnecessarily, that for her to live, you had to die. And I told her, you wouldn't die for anyone, but I'm not sure that's true. And what you taught us through your life, that a heart is a transferable thing, body to body. If we believe, as you believed, in the mind's miracles, in the way, step by step, we discover that of which we are capable, to give life where there is no life, And to speak from the heart is to speak from the source of what is and isn't yours or ours. Will she allow me to place my hand on her chest so that I can feel your familiar pulsing? And further, will she consent to my request to rest my ear against her breast so that I can close my eyes and imagine the way I would hear your steady rhythm as we lay beside each other in that small room another life ago? And in that dark, will you live again? Several years ago, I had the opportunity to visit the Auschwitz concentration death camp, and while I was there, I remembered the famous quote by Theodor Adorno when he said, "To write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric." But of course, we have to try to continue to do so anyway. The poem references the pond that I have at home, actually, which is an interesting connection. It's called "At Auschwitz, Birkenau." And I respond to Theodor Adorno when he said to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. No poetry in the railroad track that starts at the Welcome Center and ends at the crematorium, in the barbed wire sectioning off the tall grasses of the flowering mustard and clover and violets. Nothing planted, everything wild, nothing touched, everything as it was, chimneys without their barracks, red brick stacks rising out of the earth as if to filter smoke from a fire raging under the ground. The midsummer, mid-afternoon sun blazing as if it could torch this all away. No poetry in the one barrack still intact, still displaying the date of its construction, 1942, the pine 2x4s nailed at right angles, the rows of holes dug into the floor for toilets, the dark odors and dust swirls, the laser beams of light shafting through the narrow slats, the claustrophobic triple-deck beds, 1 8 to a bunk, the dirt floors, the rats carrying the diseases, the Polish words scrawled on the cracked concrete wall, keep clean, no talking. No poetry in the central yard, across which husbands and wives would search through barbed wires for each other's eyes. None. Or in the monument to the victims, boulders falling into each other, plaques in 50 languages bearing the same message about how this place is a cry of despair and a warning. No poetry in the 65 years that passed since they were kicked out of cattle cars and hauled past where I stand now, close enough to brush my shoulders, marching through the air my body now inhabits, filing one after another and stepping down into the large stomach of the crematorium that was exploded by its creators, but you can still see the space inside where they last breathed. No poetry on the black swamp the chips of their bones and the ashes of their flesh ended up in, where I am startled by the glassy eyes of the green frog who gazes up at me from the bank, the crouched body stock still, like the one my daughter pointed my attention toward near our pond at home. We'd pause for the screech and the leap. This one screeches. It leaps. No, it splashes among the blessed shards. Poetry. This next poem is from the title. The title poem is called The Torah Garden. It goes back to the tension that I was talking about of the garden, nature, and law, the Torah, both of which I love, but they're kind of at loggerheads in some ways. According to religious Orthodox Judaism, the garden, the earth, is kind of a distraction from God's law, but Judaism thankfully has expanded since then, and actually Judaism, like many other traditions, are based in paganistic, ritualistic, environmental nature. And so also the poem deals with that, but also it deals with the idea of the Jewish New Year and the cycles, and the New Year happens in the fall, in September, around this time of year was just the Jewish New Year. And at the Jewish New Year, you blow the shofar, which is a ram's horn, and that I refer to that. The poem's in many sections. I'm only going to read a few of them. And it basically celebrates my wife's garden, and it's called the Torah Garden. I sound the shofar for the new year, and in this suspended time, my life is focused in my mouth, lips on the ram's horn I purchased in Jerusalem, rending the air with its broken notes, summoning us to renounce. Fashion a kingdom, it says. Open yourselves up to the only moment there is, this stillness, this garden hanging on like the last blast of its bellowing breath. Late afternoon on a Saturday, designated the day of rest, and so this writing is a sin against the deep powers of silence. It's difficult to think of transgression on a day so full of early spring. Four ducks splash-landed on the pond, and the daffodils are lifting their trumpets, announcing their bursting. No rest for the robins who gather their twigs and bits of grass. None for the lettuce seeds under the grow lights, already thrusting their green spears through the soil. Certainly no respite for the laborious pounding of my heart as I spy you dressing in a circle of sunlight, your flesh flushed by the love we've just made, according to some commandment. Like the Torah, for everything is in it, we turn and turn and turn over the rocky soil, haul water from the pond in drywall buckets, rake leaves, gather branches, toss hay onto the potatoes, dank wet earth for them to root down in, light filtering through the lilacs. You pick and bite the top of a garlic leaf, hand it to me, our longings like twigs in the beak of a swallow in flight, the garden in ascension, blossoms on the strawberries. So will it come to pass? Will we receive rain in its season, the former rain and the later rain? Will the ground produce its fruit? Will we gather in the corn, the broccoli, the carrots, the peas, the beans, the squash, the potatoes, the onions, the red and the white and the gold, the tomatoes of every designation, the peppers? The labor of laying down all the seeds, laying them down like the words scribbled into the book of life. So Tolstoy was wrong. Families are not happy in the same way. That the juice packed inside is also ours, that it will sweeten our tongues until our next language. The blueberries so abundant we grasp them by the handfuls, discreet and delicious and without damage, producing long after we unpin the netting and leave what remains for the birds, who will plunder until they themselves are gone. Only the frost will stop them now, proliferating until summer itself perishes, according to the instructions of however long the light lasts. I eat the fruit of your seeds, Torahs in my mouth, dwelling in the devouring flame, in this garden where we allow wildness its portion, the bat with the injured wing crawling slow as a second hand up the spruce, stuttering one step at a time, pausing high above our heads and turning, facing us in its ascension. Keep yourselves holy, because I am holy. After you're gone, you say, our shadows stretched against the tilled soil, we'll push up a tree together. And so I sound the shofar for the new year, and in this suspended time, my life is focused on my mouth, lips on the ram's horn I purchased in Jerusalem, rending the air with its broken notes, summoning us to thin ourselves out, to renounce. Fashion a kingdom, it says.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard Pennsylvania poet Philip Terman, T-E-R-M-A-N, reading from two of his books of poems, Rabbi in the Air, and his latest publication, The Torah Garden. I hope you enjoyed that reading as much as I did. I want to remind you one more time about the Word Temple Poetry Series taking place on Saturday, April 26th at 7 p.m. with Leonore Wilson, Todd Melliker, and David Rosenthal. Check it all out at wordtemple.com. And I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.